from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Feminist Theology and Biblical Scholarship, this week on Soundings. My guests are Rosemary Radford Ruther of the Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary and William Hallow of Yale University. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Rosemary Radford Ruther about modern feminism and theology. Following that, a discussion with William Hallow about early ancient Near Eastern history. Here is Rosemary Radford Ruther.
Well, I think feminism and religion are moving in two directions at once, which is to say, on the one hand, there's been a great deal of development of feminist theology, feminist studies in the last 15 to 20 years. It's a well-established field. They're very well-established writers, growing bibliography. On the other hand, there is a new kind of embattlement, which is to say that you have conservative backlash that is really trying to undo a lot of these changes. So I think that you have both of those things.
Does that have anything to do with theology and religion, strictly speaking? Is that political? Help me to understand the mixture there.
Well, I think it's both, which is to say that religion is always political. It's part of the whole cultural context in context of American society. Religion has become increasingly directly political, which is to say that it's very closely allied with conservative politics. And conservative religion functions to validate certain kind of conservative attitudes about women and the family and so on. So religion and politics are very much intertwined, and you have the conflict both in the church and in society at large.
Anything new about this? When you look at feminism and religion, feminism and theology, how far back do we go when we begin to understand the origins of what's happening today?
Well, feminism, in terms of its recent history in feminist theology, developed in the late 60s. But you can trace similar kinds of arguments, similar kinds of developments much earlier. I mean, one can find, for example, in the 17th century, Quaker writings such as Margaret Fell, who was defending the right of women to preach, and so on. There was a lot of development of what one might call feminist reflection in the 19th century. But I think what has changed in the 60s is the late 60s is that women began to be ordained and began to enter seminaries in greater numbers. You began to have women then teaching the seminaries. So it became possible to really incorporate feminist reflection into the, you might say, the official tradition, rather than having marginal people whose names tended to get lost or not incorporated.
Let me just sort of look at you wide-eyed here and say, why is there resistance? Help me to understand.
Well,
that.
I think it's a whole kind of pattern of authority and power in which the apex is symbolized by a male god, and where people identify that structure with kind of order and security and people staying in their place and so on. And there are many women very much who have been socialized into that, and they tend to be the women who are most likely to be in church on a regular basis. And so people feel that all of this is shaking up a certain kind of pattern of order, and that becomes very frightening. I have a friend, a woman theologian, who was on the Inclusive Language Lectionary Committee, which was a project sponsored by the National Council of Churches, and had men and women scholars and so on, biblical scholars. And the whole committee received death threats, and this was quite a shock for, actually the white men were more shocked because they had not really experienced hostility before.
What, over the language, the he-she stuff, that kind of
right.
thing?
I mean, they were doing a careful study of the biblical texts which are to be read in churches, and that involved both revisions of language where the original text, bore that possibility. For example, the word that's typically used in the New Testament for, which is usually translated man, is in fact a generic word, anthropos. And so it's in fact perfectly appropriate to translate that person rather than man, because it's not a male. And I mean, the word doesn't mean mm-hmm. simply a male. But it begins to change completely people's perception of the story when you then translate it, there was a person born blind,
uh-huh.
rather than there was a man born blind.
Right.
You know, it opens up the possibility that this person might be a woman.
Let's use these remarks, Rosemary Ruther, for an elaboration here. You're about to give a talk at the University of North Carolina. I believe your title is Sex and the Single Male God. What's the problem? All right, what's the problem?
Well, I'm going to suggest that both the patriarchal power structure and also classically I'll be talking very much about the Catholic context, a celibate sacerdotal power structure has combined notions of patriarchal power with an enormous kind of fears of women and sexuality, and all of that reads out as sex being one of the major areas of conflict, particularly in the Catholic Church, but also in the other churches as well.
Well, now wait, is not God sexless? Is not God omnipotent and all-powerful, all of that? I mean, why do we have to fight over the sexuality of God?
Because one gender claims power on the basis of pretending that somehow God is more like them than women.
The ultimate appeal to authority.
Right. So obviously the church in its more sophisticated theology has never taught that God was literally a human being in the first place,
mm-hmm.
and then certainly has never taught that God then literally had a gender. You know, God transcends, you know, bodily nature and so on. But nevertheless, it has predominated in male imagery for God. There is, in fact, female imagery for God, but most people don't kind of realize it. The imagery has has overwhelmingly, pictorially, been that not simply a male, but a certain kind of male, an old king.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
An elderly king. So you have a whole imagery of essentially ruling class male power. Kingly power, royal power, and so on. And people identify that, and has been identified, as I said, with a whole kind of hierarchical structure of, you know, who's in charge and who obeys and so on. And it's in that context that people become very frightened of recognizing the actual possibility of using inclusive language for God, because they see it as undermining what they presume to be a certain kind of authority structure.
Rosemary Ruther, you are a feminist theologian from Garrett Theological Seminary. Let's really stretch it a little bit here. To combine religion and feminism and theology, does that mean that I have a mother in heaven? Is that what you're after?
I don't think that's really the issue. I think the issue is, first of all, the critique of male-centered theology, which starts out with the presupposition that males are the normative human beings, that they are sort of normatively the people who should be in charge, who have the full capacities for reason and power and so on. The women are really secondary auxiliary. In fact, some of the theology even says that they're defective. They're incapable of exercising power, authority, leadership, and they're not even too smart. And so you have a whole anthropology, and then you build up a view of God as the founder of this kind of male-dominated system, and you read the Christology out of that and say women can't represent Christ, they can't represent God because God-like qualities are male. So you have a whole distortion of theology that comes out of a male perspective. So I think feminism is first of all about, feminist theology is first of all about a critique of that male-centered distortion of
mm-hmm.
theology. And an attempt to reclaim theology as a good news for both men and women.
How would you reverse this? What steps are necessary? I mean, you look at this from a sort of an academic and theological standpoint. Describe for me what's going on in the academy, and then describe for me what's happening amongst the populace.
Well, I think the steps in terms of feminist theology is, first of all, to recognize and start naming these patriarchal distortions of theology and how theology has been skewed by assumptions about male dominance, and then begin to really look about how alternative sources in the tradition for a more inclusive.
So there are precedents that you look to.
Yeah, there's a whole alternative line of thinking that mm-hmm. you can look at in the Bible and in the Christian tradition, and start reconstructing the whole imagery of God and Christ and ministry and church and so on for a more inclusive perspective. And by inclusive perspective, I don't simply mean you sort of add women and stir, but that you really start thinking about both men and women as more holistic people, and relating to each other in a more mutual way rather than as kind of split personalities or one dominant, one subordinate. What you have here is a general tendency to read every human structure as simply a reflection of nature.
Uh-huh.
And so one of the key challenges of all modern movements of emancipation is to challenge the notion that class hierarchy, racism, slavery, and patriarchy are natural.
Are we talking about biology? Are we talking about genetics? Or are we talking about nurture? Are we talking about what people invent to do to themselves?
I'm talking about ideology at the moment.
And that's an invented thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's essentially an unjust privileged power structure, which then claims that its power structure is natural and divinely ordained and can't be changed.
It's good because it is.
It is, and God wants it that way, and it simply is the order of nature. So that has been a major argument for all of these kinds of hierarchical structures. I mean, until women actually got the opportunity to be in higher education, it would have been generally believed by everybody that women simply were incapable of a higher education. And you had doctors, for example, in the late 19th century arguing vehemently and using all kinds of pseudo-medical evidence that women biologically were incapable of a higher education, that their natural energies were focused in only one place, which is reproduction. And if they got into higher education, all this energy would be distorted into their brains, and they would become sterile, sickly invalids, etc. You know, all this.
No, those aren't. Those are not exaggerations.
Yeah, no, that's. I can cite authorities that said that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's just simply false. I mean, sometimes I've sort of thought that it'd be nice if intellectual endeavors. Made you less susceptible to pregnancy, but it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Doesn't have. So I mean, there's been all kinds of pseudo science that has grown up around justifying structures of unjust privilege toward women. The fact is that most of what we call nature is social constructs.
Rosemary Ruther, let's conclude our conversation. How do you intend to accomplish what you're after as a feminist theologian? You want to keep a certain section of the crowd happy? You don't want to antagonize the rest? What do you do?
Well, I don't think it's possible to avoid antagonizing people. The most you can do is try to avoid unnecessary antagonism, which is to say that you are asking people to step down for some privilege. And there's no way you can do that without the people who identify with that privilege being antagonized and engaging in backlash. So these social change never comes about without struggle, personal and social, and one has to be perfectly aware of that. But I think one needs to avoid unnecessary antagonism, which is to say that one shouldn't antagonize the people who ought to be your friends. And that means that you try to communicate the issues clearly in such a way as to get the largest number of people possible to realize that it's in their best interest to make these changes.
Rosemary Radford Ruther is a professor at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. Rosemary Radford Ruther's most recent book is Contemporary Catholicism, Crises and Challenges, published by Sneed and Ward in 1987. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a discussion about early ancient Near Eastern history and biblical scholarship. My guest is William Hallow of Yale University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, William Hallow worked on a forthcoming study entitled The Origins of Modern Institutions in the Ancient Near East. Here is William Hallow.
I deal with the first half of history as I immodestly refer to it. If we think of history as beginning where writing begins and when writing begins in any given part of the world, then history begins at Sumer, to quote the title of the famous book by Samuel Noah Kramer, the Dean of Sumerologists, which is that branch of my field of Assyriology, which deals in particular with the earliest stratum of civilization in Mesopotamia.
How old is writing? Let's just pause on that for a moment. How far back do we go before you find the first examples?
Let's say that full writing, with the ability to express most anything that is said, begins before the end of the fourth millennium and begins first in Lower Mesopotamia, where Tigris and Euphrates come together to merge into the Persian Gulf or Arabian Gulf, as you prefer, or the Sumerian Gulf, as a recent Times editorial suggested we might call it. That is where and when it began. And with the beginnings of writing, there's the beginning of the possibility of recording the events that have transpired, of transmitting them to subsequent generations, and therefore of history as such. So if we date that around about 3000 BC, and think of cuneiform writing, which developed from this first stage of writing, as the characteristic writing of Mesopotamia, as the vehicle in which the records of Assyriology are preserved, then that writing continued until the very beginnings of the Christian era. And in the writing was contained an imperishable record of all that they did and all that they thought about. The greatest number of texts are indeed archival in character, as I would call them. Economic texts, more frequently, is the term applied. They cover not only the activities of the economy, but legal matters, letters, and all manner of documents reflective of daily life. But a significant number of texts were also devoted to the historical recording of what transpired in the high realms of statecraft. These are texts which I describe as monumental because most often they constituted monuments intended to be preserved for all future generations, and they've served that purpose well, since today we can reconstruct the history of the great deeds of the kings and of the states in Mesopotamia 5,000 and 4,000 and 3,000 years after they transpired.
Bill Hallow, spend a few minutes and talk to me about the term prehistory. This obviously did not happen in a vacuum. We associate what the beginning of the historical enterprise and history, what we call history, with writing. What happened before that? How does a scholar go about reconstructing, making what accurate, substantial guesses about that sort of thing?
Well, I'll be brief because the prehistorians are my valued colleagues in the fields of archaeology and anthropology. I deal with history, with the emergence of a historical consciousness and historical record keeping, both in Mesopotamia and in other parts of the Near East. One of the great debates now raging in the field is when did history begin in any part of the Near East? And in particular, when did it begin in biblical Israel? I've been involved in that debate. And there's a shifting border between what is called prehistory and history there. Sometimes one fudges a little bit by speaking of an interval of proto-history between these two stages. But in Mesopotamia, this is not really a debate. Writing and history begin at the same time, but writing is only one of the components of what we might describe as civilization. And Mesopotamia is fascinating for us, a type case by second to none in the ancient record, because we can see the emergence of a whole cluster of phenomena that together constitute civilization. In addition to writing, for example, we must point to the emergence of cities as a key feature. In fact, the very word civilization derives from the Latin word civitas, city-state, and the city-state in Mesopotamia, as later in Greece, was at the heart of the civilizing process. This is where the populations congregated behind the safety of monumental walls and under the shadow of royal palaces and of temples in order to create a first civilization. And a third major component was the accumulation of capital, the accumulation and the concentration of population in cities allowed the accumulation of surplus from the agricultural base of prosperity, allowed enough people to specialize to create works of art that have endured, and therefore provided that third leg of this tripod basis of civilization.
Bill Hallow, tell me about what you are terming literary texts. What is their relationship to these other categories that you've been describing as we look at early history, writing, that sort of thing?
Yes, the text that colleagues generally describe as literary texts, I prefer to describe as canonical texts. That is to say, texts which collectively constitute a canon, not in the sense necessarily of the biblical canon, that is, as having religious authority and sanctity, but in the sense of being a formal official curriculum of the scribal schools, and therefore the common core of knowledge that was aspired to by all graduates of those schools.
In other words, the humanities early on.
They constitute a kind of witness to the early emergence of the humanities, yes. Uh-huh. And I might add that the very concept of humanity has its forerunner and precedent in the Sumerian sources.
Bill Hallow, spend a few minutes and talk to me about the relationship and the importance of what you are doing as a curator and a Assyriologist with respect to our understanding of biblical scholarship.
Well, I can illustrate that by reminding you of the situation of the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis begins in Mesopotamia. The origins of the people of Israel is set in Shinar, which is sometimes compared to Sumer, but at any rate, it is set in the east, and the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis transpire in that part of the world which we know by the Greek term of Mesopotamia, in the land later known as Babylonia. The Tower of Babel and other such features of the land of the landscape are familiar from this so-called primeval history in Genesis. And then this is followed by the move of Abraham on divine command, we're told, northward and westward, and then southward and westward, via Haran in northern Syria to the promised land of Canaan at the southwestern end of the Asiatic part of what has in the past sometimes been called the Fertile Crescent. Through chapter 37, the patriarchal narratives then deal with that great stretch of land which lies between Mesopotamia and Egypt. And then in the concluding portions, the concluding third of the book of Genesis, the scene shifts once more, and most of it is constituted by the Joseph story, which for its greatest part transpires in the land of Egypt. So the entire ancient Near East, with the possible exception of Arabia and Anatolia, the modern Turkey, provides the background for just the very first book of the Bible.
And this what? This contributes what? An archaeological, a cultural, a political, and a commercial understanding of the circumstances surrounding what some people may take to be history, other people take to be myth, yet others will combine in some way
or
another.
Well, in the much debated question of what does Genesis constitute, is it in fact history, myth, legend, is it something in between? The role of the motifs that are shared with Mesopotamia in the primeval history and with other parts of the Near East in the subsequent chapters is definitely at issue. And so I myself have pursued a balanced approach, as I like to think, in which while I have been willing to draw comparisons between the biblical evidence and the Mesopotamian, I've also been alive to the contrasts. In many cases, these contrasts are equally telling. And it's only the combination of comparison and contrast that, to my mind, makes possible a balanced approach to the material. I call it a contextual approach, an approach which sets the biblical evidence in its ancient Eastern context.
Do you feel yourself, Bill Hallow, walking on eggshells as you deal with the sacred and the secular, questions of faith and questions of hard historical evidence? Explain that to me.
There is a good deal of controversy, and heat as well as light are sometimes thrown upon the issues because of that. People who are committed to positions that are, in some cases, matters of belief rather than intellectual conviction can feel strongly in these matters. On the other hand, I feel that I am well equipped to consider the biblical evidence dispassionately. What my motto is, neither to subject the Bible to a degree of criticism not levied against the Mesopotamian sources, nor to exempt it from that criticism. So I've been able to apply the same strictures that are universally used in Assyriology in order to test the validity of the biblical record. We are witnessing almost, in a sense, a small-scale repetition of the Renaissance, which gave us our modern notion of humanism.
Goodness.
When the Greek heritage was recovered by Italian scholars who, in fact, were visited by refugees from the Greek-speaking East, bearing with them the original manuscripts, or manuscripts in the original Greek, of texts that until then had been known only in later translations or versions.
And we've got what, a sort of another, we have a counterpart for that occurring.
And we have a counterpart to that occurring as the reconstruction of Sumerian literature proceeds apace. By the discoveries made in the field, by the joining together of fragments found in varieties of museums, such as my own Yale Babylonian collection, and by the efforts that are being devoted to this enterprise by a relatively small number of specialists in the field around the world. But since I understand your program goes out over a multitude of stations around the country and around the world, I may use your invitation to say, yes, I do consider myself a guardian, not only of the texts preserved at Yale, but also of those that may lie scattered in smaller, in some cases, private collections around the country. And anyone within hearing of this program who has such cuneiform tablets or other inscriptions in their care and would like to see them evaluated, preserved, conserved, baked if need be, and deciphered, should feel free to contact me at the Babylonian Collection at Yale University, where we do consider ourselves the custodians not only of our own collection, but of all cuneiform tablet collections that are not in museum hands or not properly cared for, that may have found their way to private possession or to smaller libraries, colleges, and other institutions around the country.
William Hallow is a professor at Yale University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, William Hallow worked on a forthcoming study entitled The Origins of Modern Institutions in the Ancient Near East. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Modern Feminist Theology and Ancient Near Eastern History is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 410. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about medieval European history and literature. My guests will be James Wimsatt of the University of Texas at Austin and Seymour Phillips of University College Dublin. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Feminist Theology and Biblical Scholarship, two conversations this week on Soundings. Rosemary Radford Ruther of Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary discusses the impact of feminism on modern theology. William Hallow of Yale University talks about biblical scholarship and ancient Near Eastern history. Women and the Word, Feminist Theology and Biblical Philology, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.